What's the overall process we're looking at? The complete oxidation of glucose, right. And the complete word is important there because part one of that is called what?
Glycolysis.
And glycolysis is partial oxidation of glucose. It doesn't finish the job. That's why it's just part of the complete oxidation of glucose. And how do you know whether glucose has been completely oxidized so that you've gotten as much energy as possible out of that original fuel? What's the material sign? There would be no more hydrogen in the fuel. And what would you have left of the fuel? Carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is completely spent fuel. And we spend fuels by oxidizing them. Therefore, the output, after many steps, the output of the complete oxidation of glucose is carbon dioxide. Glycolysis doesn't spit out carbon dioxide. What does it spit out, fuel-wise? Pyruvate. That's still valuable stuff. Pyruvate is still a fuel, not as energy-rich as glucose, because we've gotten some of that energy out of glucose by glycolysis. That's why we've been able to produce some ATP, and even more important energetically, produce some reduced coenzyme, NADH and NH+. All right, so glucose is more valuable in terms of the energy content, but pyruvate, the output of glycolysis, is still a fuel because there is still a carbon skeleton that we can dismantle, and there are still hydrogen atoms connected to that skeleton that we can pick off or dehydrogenate. All right? That's why we're not done. And so glycolysis in its 10 steps is part of the overall process. We need some other part of the overall process to start where glycolysis ends. That's part two of the overall process. And what's part two called? Citric acid cycle is part two of part two. I'm asking, what is part two of the overall process?
Cellular respiration.
The citric acid cycle is part two of cellular respiration, which is already part two of the overall process. You understand what I'm saying here on this hierarchy? Overall, you have the complete oxidation of glucose, two parts. Glycolysis, cellular respiration. Glycolysis has 10 parts. Cellular respiration has 3 parts. What is the first part, which is what we're looking at in this slide? Slide 14. The first part of cellular respiration. Yeah?
Oxidative decarbonation.
Very close. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Now, it should make sense that the first part of cellular respiration is named something of pyruvate, right? Because pyruvate is the output of glycolysis. Glycolysis partially completes the job. Cellular respiration takes up the job and finishes it, starting with where glycolysis leaves off. So that's why it involves pyruvate in the first part of cellular respiration. But where does pyruvate accumulate because of glycolysis?
In the cytosol,
because that's where glycolysis takes place. And that's represented by this ecru background, or whatever color that is. That's the cytosol. It's in the cell, but it's not in the mitochondrion. Well, by now you should know well that cellular respiration occurs in eukaryotes, at least, which is what we're studying, occurs in a mitochondrion, not in the cytosol, right? So things are going to happen to that pyruvate. That's the oxidative decarboxylation part of the name. But also, the pyruvate needs to get to the space where cellular respiration takes place, which is in a mitochondria. It's in the cytosol when it's produced by glycolysis. We need to get pyruvate into the mitochondrion, or a mitochondrion, and that's part of the first part of cellular respiration. But remember what the whole name is. Oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Let's make sense of all those words. Oxidative tells you that this first part of cellular respiration is going to involve redox, just like glycolysis did, right? We oxidize fuels to get energy out of them. And when fuel gets oxidized, something else gets reduced. What are the things, by the way, that get reduced when we oxidize fuels? Yes, that's a nice specific answer. Just in general terms, what gets reduced are these taxis I want you to imagine, right? Which are coenzymes. Reduction of coenzymes transfers energy from the fuel, which gets oxidized, to the coenzyme, which becomes reduced. That happened in glycolysis. We made some NADH. We're going to make some more in this first part. That's why part of the overall name of this first part of cellular respiration is oxidative. Now look at the structural formula of pyruvate. It's a three-carbon compound, and notice it has hydrogens on it. That's why it's still fuel. There's a skeleton that can be dismantled. There are hydrogens that can be picked off. Still valuable. But notice that the carbon and two oxygens here are being highlighted in brown. It shows that one of these is O minus, but that's just that happens easily at the pH that cells live at. At a different pH, this would still have a proton on it. So instead of O minus, it would be OH. So C double bond O and that same C with an OH is what? What do you know that as already? Yeah, what? Which group?
Carboxyl.
Okay, now think about the second name, the second part of the name of this part. It's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Decarboxylating means removing carboxyls from something. Just like dephosphorylation of ATP means removing a phosphate. Okay? So this is a carboxyl group. It involves one of the three carbons that are left. But keep in mind, we have two pyruvates for each glucose, because one 6-carbon glucose in glycolysis got split into two identical pyruvates. So everything you see happening from here onward has to be multiplied by 2 if you want to think about it as per glucose. Is that all clear? To get into the mitochondrion, since a mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle, means that this fuel has to pass through both membranes, and you see that right here. Two light orange. It's like they were out of colors or something. This layer and this layer are the outer and inner membrane of the mitochondrion. What is that fully interior space in a mitochondrion called? The space between membranes, remember, is called the intermembrane space. What is the full interior called? It's called the mitochondrial matrix. Okay, so that's where this fuel is being imported into, the mitochondrial matrix. But in the process, it becomes oxidatively decarboxylated. Since it's being decarboxylated, it's being removed of this carboxyl, that's why you see CO2 coming off. The CO2 was the carboxyl that was part of the pyruvate. And I just told you a little bit ago that carbon dioxide is completely spent fuel. So this carbon dioxide and one that'll come off of the other pyruvate, two total carbon dioxides, already represent completely spent fuel. All right. That will leave, though, in each of the two fuel molecules that were the two pyruvates, a two-carbon compound. And that two-carbon compound, ignore this right here, just the two magenta C's, if that's all there were and you didn't have this SCOA here, that would be another functional group, one that we didn't study in this course, but it would be called an acetyl group. An acetyl group is what's left of the fuel, in other words, when you decarboxylate pyruvate. And it's still valuable as fuel because it still has a carbon skeleton and still has hydrogens. It's just even less energy in it than pyruvate at that point. Now, we've been talking about coenzymes, but only really one example. We've been talking about NAD as the important coenzyme, truly important, right? But here we have another coenzyme called coenzyme A, which is what CoA stands for. And the S, the sulfur atom, is really part of coenzyme A's structure. We're just not showing the detail of the rest. The thing that's special about the sulfur atom is that it has the direct ability to connect to something that it can carry. Coenzymes in general carry things, right? That's why I wanted you to think of them as taxis. Well, this is like a different fleet of taxis. Does the same sort of work, but it's a different car that carries different passengers compared to NAD. Coenzyme A will pick up what's left of the fuel after you decarboxylate pyruvate. And what's left of that fuel is an acetyl group, a two-carbon acetyl group. And when that passenger is riding in the taxi, the coenzyme A taxi, the whole thing, taxi and passenger, is therefore called acetyl coenzyme A. Coenzyme A by itself would be the empty taxi. Acetyl coenzyme A has the passenger in it, and the passenger is what's left of the fuel, which was originally glucose. All right, now in that process, back to the oxidative part of the name, notice that an empty taxi of NAD, specifically NAD plus, you know, or hopefully you know that NAD plus is the oxidized version, right? Which is what, the high energy or the low energy version? That's the low energy version. An empty taxi has not picked up its energetic passenger. So the oxidized version is the lower energy. That goes hand in hand with what we're doing to the fuel. We're removing energy from the fuel by oxidizing it. That reduces the coenzyme because it picks up the energy in the form of hydrogens. So that's what's happening here. NAD plus becomes reduced to NADH and H plus. This is exactly like the NADH and H plus that was produced in two different places in glycolysis. All right? And it's valuable stuff because it actually is carrying more energy than an ATP molecule. So it's just not in final form. The goal is ATP. So once you get there, you're done. I mean, that ATP that's produced along the way, nothing else needs to be done to it. It's ready to go. But NAD is not yet in the final form. You want the energy that NAD is carrying, or NADH, I should say, you want to put that in the form of ATP. But an individual NADH is carrying enough energy to eventually produce multiple ATPs. And that will be the big payoff at the end of cellular respiration. All right, so that explains the whole name, right? It's the oxidative. This production of NADH is the oxidative part. Decarboxylation, removal of CO2, of pyruvate, the fuel that's remaining from glycolysis. That leaves an even lower energy fuel, which is a two-carbon compound called an acetyl group that gets picked up by coenzyme A as acetyl coenzyme A. And that's the first part of cellular respiration. Notice that there is no ATP produced in this step. But there's something even more valuable produced, NADH and H+. Okay, now let's go to 15. This shows you first and second part of cellular respiration. So the top of this figure is what we just looked at. It's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The fuel is simply depicted as carbon atoms, as a skeleton. We're ignoring the rest of the structure. It's important, of course, but it's showing you the dismantling of the skeleton. So pyruvate is depicted as simply three carbons. Right? The decarboxylation takes one of those carbons off in the form of CO2, leaving an acetyl group, which gets picked up by an empty coenzyme A, forming acetyl coenzyme A. This is a taxi that does its job of delivering the passenger. It doesn't have to go far. It drops it off to the very next part of the overall, of the cellular respiration process. And that second part of cellular respiration is the citric acid cycle, or the Krebs cycle, or the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Any of those three names. You see that happening right here. Well, the taxi, coenzyme A, does not go to the citric acid cycle. It doesn't go into it. It just goes to the door of the citric acid cycle and drops the acetyl group with its two carbons into the citric acid cycle itself. That will empty the taxi again. This coenzyme A taxi, now that it's empty, can go back and pick up more acetyl over and over, just like real taxis do. They don't just deal with one passenger ever. They keep doing it over and over. Okay, now, the details of the citric acid cycle aren't shown here. We'll look at more detail in a minute. But you can see the important highlights of what's happening in the citric acid cycle. One thing that the citric acid cycle accomplishes is that it completes the oxidation of what's left of the fuel. Okay, we've stepwise been oxidizing the fuel ever since glycolysis. We've been getting a little bit of energy out at a time. By the time the citric acid cycle is complete, the rest of the CO2 gets released. So you see two CO2s coming off of here. That's because the acetyl group has two carbons in it. When you dismantle that, each one comes off as a CO2. But two CO2s means per pyruvate. Per glucose, it would be four, because you made two pyruvates out of that original glucose. So these four CO2s plus the two from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, one per pyruvate, add up to the six carbon dioxides that tell you you've totally spent your fuel, right? Because you started with a six carbon glucose, and now by the time you're done with the citric acid cycle, you have six one carbon CO2s that don't have any hydrogen on them, and therefore they are totally spent fuel. So that's one thing the citric acid cycle does. It completes the oxidation of the fuel. But notice it also gives us some valuable stuff, because it makes three more reduced coenzymes. NAD plus gets reduced into NADH three times in the citric acid cycle. So each one of these is really valuable. Three of them is three times as valuable, obviously. You also have a different kind of coenzyme here working, very similar to NAD. What does NAD stand for? Keeping in mind you won't have your notes to look at during the test. Yes, although, let me just say it a little bit more smoothly. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Thanks for answering. Well, this is a very similar taxi, but it's like a different company. Carries the same things.
There's three so far.
But there are three coenzymes that we're talking about now. But the F here stands for flavin. Otherwise, it's built the same way, except instead of having that nicotinamide nitrogenous base, which is the part of NAD that actually receives the electrons and protons, flavin is the name of the nitrogenous base in FAD. F-L-A-V-I-N.
F-A-L?
F-L-A, sorry. F-L-A-V-I-N. Now, remember how I explained why the reduced form of NAD is symbolized as NADH plus H plus? Well, FAD has an oxidized and a reduced form as well, but the oxidized form, notice, is FAD, not FAD plus. You still have four particles to work with. When you take off two hydrogens, you have two electrons and two protons, just like I told you for NAD. But since FAD isn't plus to begin with, that means you can stick on both electrons and both protons, which, when you combine those, you really have two hydrogens. So the reduced form of FAD is FADH2, and you don't have anything left over. Does that make sense? This is valuable stuff as well. Enough energy for multiple ATPs. For reasons that I'll show you later, it's not quite as valuable as NADH, but almost. So we reduce some coenzymes. That's another important part of the citric acid cycle. And we also contribute to the goal because there's some ATP that gets produced. Now, this ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle gets produced in the same way that the ATP produced in glycolysis gets produced, which is how?
Substrate level
what? Well, there's an enzyme involved, which is why it's called substrate level, because enzymes bind to substrates. But phosphorylation, that's what you're doing to ADP to turn it into ATP, phosphorylating it, right? Sticking a phosphate on, an additional phosphate in this case. So this ATP is ready to go. That's part of the goal. But the ATP that we've made in two different places, glycolysis and now citric acid cycle, is not all that much ATP compared to how much you could make given the amount of energy that's stored in the original fuel, glucose. That's why, even though at step part two of cellular respiration here, the citric acid cycle, even though we have spent the fuel, there's nothing left of it, we're not done yet because we have a lot of energy still locked up in the form of reduced coenzymes that haven't delivered their energetic passengers off yet, which will allow that energy, some of it, to be used to make a lot more ATP. The fuel's gone, but the energy from that fuel is still usable. It's just being carried by taxis, coenzymes. Is that all nice? Okay. Let's look at the little bit more detail of the citric acid cycle in 16. Now you can see there are eight steps. The citric acid cycle is a biochemical pathway, just like any other pathway we've been talking about. So it's a serial or end-to-end arrangement of individual chemical reactions. But unlike a linear pathway that has a beginning and an end, a cycle has the end of the pathway feed back to the first part, the first step. So between 8 and 1 here, where oxaloacetate is, it's kind of like the start-finish line of a racetrack. All right, just feeds back onto itself. Well, think about what we're trying to do to the fuel. What are we actually trying to do to the fuel to get as much energy as possible out of it? Yes, and what else? We do more than just dehydrogenate. Otherwise, we would be left not with CO2s, but with a 6-carbon skeleton with no hydrogens. What else do we do besides dehydrogenate?
Decarbonization.
Well, yes, that's part of what the answer I'm looking for. We also want to dismantle the carbon skeleton. Break it into individual carbons, right? To get all the energy out of it. Because there's energy in the CC bonds just like there's energy in the CH bonds. So that's really, in a sense, what we're trying to accomplish. Break it down into smaller skeleton. Well, look at what's happening here at this start-finish line. We have an intermediate called oxaloacetate that is at the end of one turn of this cycle. And notice its structural formula. It has 4 carbons in it. And then acetyl coenzyme A is delivering an acetyl group from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, the previous step. It's delivering that to the citric acid cycle, and it drops off the acetyl group, which is a 2-carbon compound that gets added to oxaloacetate to form citrate, or citric acid, which is why it's named this, which is a 6-carbon compound. So you're doing really the opposite of what you're wanting to do, in a sense, because instead of dismantling a carbon skeleton, you're building one up even bigger. But that allows then for another turn of the cycle, and at 2 different places, namely here at steps 3 and 4, 1 carbon comes off in the form of CO2 at a time. So as long as you keep running this, each CO2 that comes off is like 1 of the carbons in the acetyl that enters. And this is why, at this point, you don't have any fuel left. These CO2s are the other ones that you haven't yet gotten rid of. You know, you got rid of the CO2 in the first part of cellular respiration because of the decarboxylation step. Here you're decarboxylating again. And for each pyruvate, you have 1 in the first step, 2 in the citric acid cycle, but you have 2 pyruvates, so 6 overall CO2s. Complete dismantling of the carbon skeleton of glucose. Okay, but notice that at 3 different places, you reduce NAD plus into NADH, NH plus, valuable. At step 6, you reduce FAD to FADH2, valuable. And at step 5, you make some ATP via substrate level phosphorylation, part of the goal. This won't continue going around in a cycle, though, unless you continuously feed it with more acetyl groups being driven by coenzyme A. Okay, 17. This is kind of a 2-in-1 figure because it's partially an anatomical cartoon and partly a graph. Notice the graph. It's a graph when you consider this y-axis has G as its units. G is free energy, as you already know, right? So the higher on this figure, the higher the G value. And what I mean by an anatomical diagram is that these big purple things, 4 big ones, the ones that are labeled with Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, and 4, those are complexes of proteins, or they are protein complexes, in other words. And anatomically speaking, even though you don't see the membrane here, they are embedded in a membrane. Now, what membrane am I talking about?
The inner one.
The inner mitochondrial membrane, exactly. The outer membrane is not what we're looking at here. The mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. the inner mitochondrial membrane is different from the outer mitochondrial membrane. What way have I told you that it's different back when we were first studying mitochondria? A lot more surface area because it has a lot of folds in it, right? What are those folds called?
Christi,
exactly. So the outer membrane is just basically as big as it needs to be to contain the inner membrane. The inner membrane is much more membrane material because it folds back and forth a lot of times. That increase in surface area allows for a lot more copies of what you're looking at here. This is just one copy of millions, but this one copy collectively made up of these four major complexes plus other things is called an electron transport chain. And I make a point to say an electron transport chain because there are millions of them. A lot of textbooks will talk about the electron transport chain like there's only one of them. They're all the same. They're copies of each other, but this is just one of them we're looking at. And the more surface area you have in that inner mitochondrial membrane, the more copies you can have, and therefore the more processing can take place, the more cellular respiration can take place. Okay, now, so you don't see the phospholipid bilayer, but it's there, and these are embedded in it. They are membrane-bound protein complexes, in other words. All right, now, an electron transport chain is well named because what it accomplishes is electron transport, movement of electrons. But it's movement of electrons from one member of the chain to the next. And now, it's an old-fashioned analogy, but it's kind of like a bucket brigade, if any of you know what I mean by that. You know what I mean by a bucket brigade? Well, if you live out in the middle of nowhere on a farm and your barn is burning, you have one source of water. You don't have water service from a city. You have a well somewhere on your property. Your barn is burning. Your neighbors notice. They run over to help. And instead of everyone running back and forth from the well to the fire, it's a lot more efficient if people just line up. One person next to the well, one person next to that person, and so on until they get close to the fire. And instead of running back and forth with full buckets of water, the first person gets a bucket of water, passes it to the next, and so on down the line. The last person dumps it on the fire, and they keep doing that. This is much like that, except it's not buckets of water, it's electrons that are being transported from member to member of the chain. Now, since it's electrons that are being received by a member and then passed on to the next member, how would you describe that chemically? What is happening? Since it's electrons. Exactly. It's a series of redox reactions. Because when the first member of the chain receives electrons, what is happening to that first member? It's becoming reduced. It's not going to stay reduced, though, just like the first person in a bucket brigade is not just going to hold on to the bucket of water during an emergency. It's going to pass it on immediately, pass the electron on immediately to the second member, which will reoxidize the first member, and it'll reduce the second member, and so on down the line. Okay? Yeah?
Would it be considered like a redox reaction?
Yeah, it's a series of redox reactions, one after another. Every time an electron gets transferred, it's by definition a redox reaction. All right, now where do these electrons come from?
From the fuel source.
From the fuel, exactly. That's the original source of the electrons. So glucose, originally, had those electrons as part of a hydrogen atom in that glucose. Or as part of hydrogen atoms, I should say. Right? We get energy from the fuel by dehydrogenating the fuel. That dehydrogenation takes away electrons and protons from the fuel. The electrons end up, after being carried by the taxis that get reduced in glycolysis and in cellular respiration and in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, three sources of full taxis along the way so far. Well, now they have a destination. All these taxis are driving. They've picked them up at different places, but they're all driving to the same destination, which is an electron transport chain, so they can dump those electrons off to the first member of the chain. Notice you have NADH up here dropping off an electron, E minus. So when that happens, the first member of the chain gets reduced, but NADH gets reoxidized into an empty taxi, which is a really important step.
Yeah.
It's really important that the taxis become reoxidized, because if they can't reoxidize, they can't go pick up more passengers in the earlier process or processes. They need to go back to glycolysis and the earlier parts of cellular respiration to do the same thing they've already done over and over. Okay? All right, so here is why, by the way, I a little bit ago told you that FADH2 is valuable but not quite as valuable as NADH. NADH is more valuable because it can dump its electrons directly onto the first complex, whereas FADH2 can only dump it off to the second complex. The reason that's not as valuable is why you should think of this also as a graph. Notice this diagonal arrangement. That's not because they're diagonally arranged anatomically in the membrane. That's because the diagonal aspect here shows you that each time an electron gets transferred, it goes down a little bit in energy. It ends up getting a little closer to whatever atomic nucleus it's associated with at the moment. And closer to the nucleus means lower energy level.
Not a little how H2 is off the scale.
Yeah, but it's that's actually not supposed to be a G representation anymore. That's why it's off of the graph. Yeah. This one is still, but this is not.
Well, if NADH is, in this case, a better source of coenzyme than FADH, why is FADH used at all?
Just because it won't work with the enzyme complexes that FAD does. It's just the way it evolved and works. Okay, now, if you think about a real bucket brigade, that's not going to work for very long it's not going to accomplish any fire extinguishing if the last member of the chain doesn't get rid of the bucket, right? That last member's job is to spill the water onto the fire, get rid of that bucket, and only if that person does that can that last member take another bucket from the next to last member. Can't keep accepting buckets if you already have buckets still that you're holding. And similarly, the last member of the electron transport chain has to have somewhere to give that electron to if it's ever going to be able to receive more electrons. And that's a really important job. That is almost the only reason that you have to breathe oxygen. Oxygen otherwise can be harmful to you. But the nice thing about oxygen is that because of its high electronegativity, it will gladly take electrons from this last member of the chain. And as a matter of fact, it not only takes electrons, but also protons from solution. Electron and proton together make up a hydrogen atom, and therefore hydrogen added to oxygen that you breathe becomes water. That's why water is an output of the overall summary reaction. The complete oxidation of glucose involves CO2 as an output, but it also involves water. This is water that wasn't water before, so you're chemically making water as part of your cellular respiration, by adding hydrogens in the form of electrons and protons from the food you ate to oxygen that you breathe to make that water. Right? And notice that's a big jump in that final step of G. G's up here, the last member, way down here for oxygen. And that's why it's so willing to do to happen. A big negative delta G means it's going to happen easily, right? Okay, now, what we've done at this point is taken energy in the form of reduced coenzymes, delivered those electrons to an electron transport chain that allows the electrons to lose energy until it finally gets to oxygen. Why is this not wasteful? Because at this point, already we're done with our fuel, right? Fuel's already gone in the previous step. The energy that hasn't already been wasted is heat. The useful energy that remains from what was originally glucose is in the form of these reduced coenzymes, the full taxis. Well, now we've emptied the taxis, and we've let the electrons lose their energy. Why is that not wasteful? Well, it would be if that were the only thing happening. But that's electron transport isn't the only thing that an electron transport chain accomplishes. As a matter of fact, it's just a way for the chain to do the important thing that it does. And that involves these big complexes. Well, it involves three of them. Complexes 1, 3, and 4, the biggies here, do double duty. They are members of the chain, so they transfer electrons to the next member. But they also serve as proton pumps. So keep in mind where these things are. You can't see the anatomical detail, but this whole chain is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. And these 1, 3, and 4 complexes are not only membrane-bound in that inner mitochondrial membrane, they are not only integral proteins, they are transmembrane proteins, so they stick all the way through the thickness, right? Which allows them to serve as transport proteins. Allows something to move from one side of the membrane to the other. Okay, so they're not only transport proteins, I just told you a little bit ago that they're proton pumps. And what does that tell you? The fact that they are specifically pumps tells you what? They are, what did you say, about gradients? Yes, they are. In other words, they are accomplishing active transport to move things against their gradient, right? And the things that are being moved are the protons. So when you dehydrogenate fuel, you're taking off two subatomic particles, electrons and protons, right? The electrons get moved down the chain. The protons get pumped from one side of the membrane to the other. And specifically, they get moved from the mitochondrial matrix, where they're being pumped from, through the inner membrane into the intermembrane space. Now, how does a pump work? If it works for active transport, what does that actually mean? What is it? Go ahead. Right, you have to supply an external source of energy. Now, we studied pumps before, right? Like a proton pump in the plant and sodium-potassium exchange pumps like occur in us animals. What was the source of energy? ATP. Well, think about what our goal here is. Our goal in this whole process is to produce ATP. So it would be pretty silly to power the pumps with ATP, right? When we're trying to produce ATP. Nevertheless, if you're pumping something, you have to supply energy. So what is the source of the energy? It is the loss of energy from the electrons as they go from one member to the other. This is really the specific part of organisms that are like the multi-step hydroelectric plant that we looked at in an earlier chapter, where a little bit of water spills over one turbine and then more over the next and so on. That's what's happening here. This is the manageable, instead of the explosive release of energy all at once, this is the manageable release of energy a little bit at a time. Some of that is wasted as heat, of course, but at complexes 1, 3, and 4, it can be harnessed, some of that energy from the electrons, can be harnessed to pump protons, the other part of the hydrogen atom, through them, creating a proton gradient. Okay? But only as long as the pumping continues. And the pumping will continue only as long as the energy source is there. And the energy source is not just electrons, it's the transfer of the electrons. So electrons have to keep spilling down through these chains, which will all come to a halt if oxygen's not present, because it'll just fill up with electrons. And the last member can't get rid of its electrons. All right, that's why you die without oxygen, because your electron transport chains fill up. You can't pump any more protons. And therefore, you can't do what the job of this proton gradient is, which is what we haven't looked at yet. But I keep telling you over and over in this term that a gradient is a source of potential energy, right? That can do some work for you. So at this point, we've spent our fuel long ago at this point. And we've even gotten rid of the energy that our reduced coenzymes were carrying. But it's not wasteful, because we've accomplished the creation of a proton gradient because of this pumping of protons. And that is now where the usable energy that was originally in glucose is, in the form of a proton gradient that electron transport chain complexes produce. Any questions on that? All we need now is to have a big payoff, allow that gradient to work for us to make a lot more ATP, which is the goal, than has already been made earlier in glycolysis and the citric acid cycle via substrate level phosphorylation. Well, we're going to make not only a lot more ATP, but we're going to do it a different way. Rather than substrate level phosphorylation, this is going to be oxidative phosphorylation. That brings us to slide 18. So now you finally see a little bit of membrane. Now this, we're not looking at the electron transport chain anymore. But there would be one right next door here if we saw the rest of the membrane. What we're looking at in this little piece of membrane is just one of millions of copies of this tiny molecular machine. This tiny molecular machine is called an ATP synthase. Now, syn means together. Synthase should tell you that's an enzyme, right? It's an enzyme named for the fact that it accomplishes the synthesis of two things. To synthesize means to bring together. The things that are brought together by this enzyme are inorganic phosphate and ADP. And when you synthesize those two, Really, that's another way of saying that you are phosphorylating the ADP to create ATP. So this is a little bit different because the phosphate that gets added to ADP is not being carried by a substrate like it was earlier. It's just inorganic phosphate as part of the phosphate pool. Okay, I said that this is a molecular machine because what that means is that there's movement involved. A machine has moving parts. Let's look at the fact that there are two colors here, violet and purple, to indicate that there are two major components to this ATP synthase. One is a stator. Just like a motor will have a stator and a rotor. The stator means it's static. Unmoving is what static means. It stays in place. The rotor rotates with respect to the stator. Okay, same thing with this little machine. The stator keeps it well embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane, just like any membrane-bound protein. It's not covalently connected to those phospholipids. It's able to move around within the membrane, but it doesn't go through the membrane, right? Either direction. It stays buoyant in that membrane. But that's the stator. It does not move. The rotor does. And notice that the rotor attached to this shaft, which on the mitochondrial matrix end of the rotor, so this is this catalytic knob here is not actually in the membrane, it's in the mitochondrial matrix, but it's connected to the rotor, or it's part of the rotor, I should say. Well, the word catalytic knob should tell you that that's where the enzyme activity is, right? An enzyme is a catalyst. What's that?
For the activation sites.
Exactly. And this catalytic knob is really multiple enzymes in one. Remember when we looked at allosteric regulation, we had that four subunit multimeric enzyme that had, since it had four subunits, each one had its own active site. Well, here we have a catalytic knob that's made up of multiple knobby parts, each of which has its own active site. Now, each active site, of course, is the place on that catalytic knob where the two substrates, inorganic phosphate and ADP, combined. Right? They are the substrates. So they get bound temporarily. And just like for any enzyme, or any catalyst for that matter, even more generally, there will be a lowering of activation energy, which will make it much more likely for those reactants to react. The reactants are the substrates. But in this case, the activation energy can't get lowered. In other words, the enzyme cannot do the job of speeding that reaction up unless the knob gets deformed into a certain shape. And it can't get deformed into that shape unless the rotor is rotating. So the rotation of the rotor, one by one, deforms each of these little pieces of the catalytic knob, which is its own enzyme, really. And it's that deformation, that change in shape, that actually allows the speeding up of the phosphorylation of ADP with inorganic phosphate to produce ATP. This doesn't happen for free, in other words, because, of course, it's not going to rotate unless you force it to rotate. Well, what forces it to rotate is diffusion of hydrogen ions. All right? So even though the electron transport chain isn't shown here, remember what it accomplished. The loss of energy by the electrons being transferred is put to use, causing three subunits in each chain to function as pumps to pump protons from the matrix, this yellow space, through the inner membrane to the intermembrane space, the dark orange space. Okay? This is very similar to putting in effort to lift water so that you can then spill the water downhill to turn a water wheel. Only it's hydrogen ions instead of water. The effort to bring those protons to one side, concentrate them here, that effort came in the form of energy released from the fuel. Right? Now we have the payoff. The protons, now that they are concentrated on one side of the membrane, now that they are in the intermembrane space at much higher concentration than in the matrix, means that there is a tendency for them to diffuse. The gradient itself is a tendency to diffuse, right? But what's the other requirement for diffusion to actually occur? You have to have a gradient, and what's the other requirement? You have to have a way to get down that gradient. So the gradient makes the protons want to come through, but they are protons, plenty small. They're even smaller than an atom, right? So they're plenty small. That's no problem. What is the problem is that they are charged, and charged particles don't want to be next to those nonpolar tails of the phospholipid. So they don't care where they get through the membrane to get back into the matrix, but the only places that they're allowed through because of their charge are the many copies of ATP synthase. And when they do that, that's what spins the rotor. And the spinning of the rotor deforms the catalytic knob so that it will work as an enzyme to synthesize or bring together inorganic phosphate and ADP to produce ATP. That's oxidative phosphorylation. Now, oxidative phosphorylation is the name for the third part of cellular respiration, if you recall. But even though that's part three of part two already, part three of cellular respiration has two components. Do you remember what those are? The two parts of oxidative phosphorylation are electron transport, which we just covered, and chemiosmosis, which is what this is. Chemiosmosis refers to the diffusion of hydrogen ions down their gradient, which spins the rotors of ATP synthase, which accomplishes the phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. And that produces most, by far most, over 90% of the ATP that's produced from the energy in one glucose comes in this final step. That's a testament to just how important those taxis are. I keep telling you that they're really valuable, each one. They're carrying more energy than is necessary to make one ATP. They can make multiple because each taxi, because of the transfer of electrons down the chains, pumps a lot of protons. And the proton gradient, as long as it's held in place, means that this thing's going to keep spinning, producing a lot of ATP. Is that clear? Okay, so electron transport is necessary so that chemiosmosis can happen. But chemiosmosis is the part of oxidative phosphorylation that actually involves the phosphorylation. And so it's the part that is the big final payoff in terms of the goal, which is to produce ATP. All right, let's go to 19 now and look at a picture that puts oxidative phosphorylation all on one slide. So this isn't the whole process. This isn't even the whole cellular respiration. This is just part three of cellular respiration, which involves electron transport and chemiosmosis. Those two things combined are oxidative phosphorylation. So we see the membrane here. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane, not the plasma membrane. Dark orange is the intermembrane space. Yellow is the mitochondrial matrix. And notice that complexes 1, 3, and 4 of an electron transport chain are the big ones that are transmembrane. They stick all the way through the thickness. That's what allows them to operate as transport proteins. They're going to more specifically operate as pumps, though, because they're going to move something against its gradient, and what gets moved are protons. Protons that each one is really just half of a hydrogen that came from fuel, right? Well, you have to power pumps with something. These are powered by energy that's released by electron transport. The electrons are the other halves of the hydrogens that came from the fuel. So, yes, we dehydrogenate fuel, we remove hydrogen, but the two parts of each hydrogen, electron and proton, end up doing different things for a while. The electrons get transferred down the chains. That allows for energy to be released, some of which is harnessed by the pumps to pump the protons, the other part of the hydrogen atoms, from the matrix through the inner mitochondrial membrane into the intermembrane space. There is therefore a high concentration of protons or hydrogen ions or H plus in the intermembrane space. What does that mean about its pH compared to the matrix? It is more acidic. What does it say about its pH? It's lower. Right, because of this high concentration of hydrogen ions, that by definition is a lower pH. It's more acidic in that compartment. But the gradient, which is there only because of proton pumping by the electron transport chain, is where the still usable energy from glucose originally is at this point. And that produces the tendency for the hydrogen ions to diffuse down that gradient passively back into the matrix. It's just that they can't get through the main part of the membrane because they are positively charged. The only places they're allowed through are at ATP synthase molecules, and that diffusion causes the spinning of the rotor, causing the phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Okay, so those are the two components of part three of cellular respiration. Electron transport and chemiosmosis combine to make up part three, which is oxidative phosphorylation. And that is a little bit different from substrate level phosphorylation because the substrate's not handing off a phosphate to ADP, it's just inorganic phosphate by itself. Nevertheless, the ATP that gets produced is identical to the ATP that's produced earlier by substrate-level phosphorylation. Just produced differently. But the other difference is that this produces a hell of a lot more. All right. Now, in 20, we can see a summary. Again, this looks very similar to the summary slide we started with earlier in the chapter. There are a little bit more details, like numbers of ATP produced. But it's really basically the same slide. Now it should make more sense to you, though, because we've been through it. The overall process, summarized here, is the complete oxidation of glucose. So that's where you start with glucose. That's one input into part one, which is glycolysis. What are the other two inputs, material inputs into glycolysis, besides glucose? Can't have glycolysis without glucose, but what are the other requirements? ADP, exactly. And oxidized coenzymes, and specifically NAD+. So it has to be the right kind of taxi from the right fleet. And NAD plus is required, or I shouldn't say NAD plus. NAD plus is required. ADP is required. Glucose is required. 10 steps in two phases, remember. Energy investment phase, and energy payoff phase. But after those 10 steps, the three material outputs are NADH, reduced coenzymes, in other words, ATP, higher energy nucleotides, which is the goal, and what's left of the fuel at that point, which is two pyruvate molecules per glucose. Now, a non-material output is the heat that's wasted in all these steps. You harness some of the energy in the fuel by reducing the coenzymes and producing the ATP, but not all of it, of course. So that's part of the reason your body heats up, for instance. All right, that's where we are right here. That's the end of part one of the overall complete oxidation of glucose. If a cell is capable, which not all cells are, then it certainly makes sense to continue the process because pyruvate is only partially spent fuel. That's what cellular respiration is all about. It takes the partially spent fuel and spends it the rest of the way in three parts. What does this white arrow represent? What is it? Exactly. In other words, part one of cellular respiration, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, takes pyruvate, decarboxylates it, which is why CO2 is produced, worthless stuff as far as energy, leaving an acetyl, still valuable fuel, that gets picked up by coenzyme A and driven to step two of cellular respiration, which is citric acid cycle. But in that process, oxidation occurs, which means reduction also occurs. And what gets reduced is another NAD plus into NADH. So you have taxi from earlier in glycolysis. You have a taxi now produced here. They're all driving to the same destination, though, which is the electron transport chain later. All right, and the citric acid, no ATP produced in that step, by the way. In step part two of cellular respiration, citric acid cycle, more ATP gets produced, but only a little. More importantly, what gets produced is a lot more reduced coenzyme, both in the form of NADH, NH+, and FADH2. Now, all of these full taxis are going to deliver their electrons, their energetic passengers, on to the first part of the final part of cellular respiration. The final part is oxidative phosphorylation, but that first part of it is specifically electron transport. So that's the destination for the taxis. They dump the electrons off. As they go down the chain, they lose a little bit of energy at a time. Some's wasted as heat, but some gets harnessed by complexes 1, 3, and 4. And that gives them the energy for those three complexes to function as pumps to take protons out of the matrix, pump them through the intermembrane into the intermembrane space. That produces the tendency for them to diffuse back in, and when they do, that's called chemiosmosis, and it happens in such a way that the rotors of the ATP synthase complexes turn, allowing them to operate as catalysts, producing, like I said, by far the majority of the ATP that can be produced. Only if you go through the entire process, though, do you get these additional ATPs. If all you do is glycolysis, just two ATPs per glucose. What were you going to ask?
Question. Why doesn't it say 32 or 34?
Because it depends on how this happens. Notice it's or.
Oh.
These NADs out here actually don't drive all the way into the electron, into the mitochondrion. Instead, they, at the wall, at the membrane itself of the mitochondrion, pass off their electrons to other taxis. And they could pass them to NADH, or they could pass them to FADH2. And if they pass them on to FADH2 instead, which is kind of like a crapshoot of which one picks them up, then remember on that figure, the FADH2 delivers them not to complex 1, but to complex 2, which is later in the chain at lower energy, and it doesn't involve, it skips pump 1. So not as many hydrogens get pumped.
32 if you did FADH2.
That's right.
It did NADH2, or two of those, then it would get to 34.
Correct.
Because they drop over the first.
And that's because when NADH drops off to the first member, that means that first of the three pumps operates. So more protons get pumped for NADH than FADH2. Right. The steeper the gradient is, the more those things spin, and the more ATP is produced.
Okay.
So that's why it's not an exact answer. It just depends on the moment, really. All right. Questions about this whole process? Well, it is the end of the whole process now. It's not the end of the chapter, but that we have gone from glucose all the way to six CO2s, completely spent fuel, and have processed the energy in various ways, but we've finally gotten it into the goal form, which is a bunch of ATPs. We've wasted some heat along the way, but we've made maximum amount of ATPs. Now, in the remaining time, I want you to think about what would happen without oxygen. In glycolysis, which is the first part of the overall process, there was no need for oxygen. Oxygen is not required for glycolysis. But, and in fact, oxygen is required until the third part of cellular respiration. Despite that, not having a need for oxygen all the way up to that final part, not having oxygen would cause everything to shut down. Now, what would immediately occur if you didn't have oxygen is that you no longer have the thing that oxygen does. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor. That's the whole reason you have to breathe. Serves as the final electron acceptor, which means it takes the electrons from the last member of each chain. If you don't have oxygen, the chains just fill up, like I said, because the last member can't dump it. Therefore, the next to the last member can't dump it. You know, backs up all the way to the first member. So that explains why a lack of oxygen would shut down the proton pumps, right? And eventually the hydrogen ions will diffuse to equilibrium, and therefore there's no more tendency to move the rotors. So you would cut off chemiosmosis, which produces a lot of ATP, but you'd cut off more than that. Because if the electrons transport chains are filled, then the taxis, the NADH and the FADH2, can no longer get rid of their passengers, because that's where they dump their passengers. All right? And if all of the taxis in the fleet are full of passengers, none will be able to go back to the earlier processes, glycolysis and oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate and citric acid cycle, all of which reduce coenzymes, right? There wouldn't be any oxidized or empty taxis to pick up more electrons. They would all be in the reduced form. So all of that earlier stuff, even though it doesn't require oxygen, would also stop. You understand what I'm saying there? Are you sure? Okay. Well, obviously that would mean cell death, and therefore organismal death. If it weren't for a process that takes care of that. And that's what we'll look at next, but I'm not going to start it yet today. I'll just tell you what the process is. That process, which is an alternative to cellular respiration, is called fermentation. And fermentation allows a cell to continue to undergo glycolysis, even when there's no oxygen. But I'll just leave it at that. We'll stick to just the laboratory for the rest of the day.